Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Welcome to Saturday Frights, the podcast. I am your co-host, the Projectionist. And now, for your host, Vic Sage.
Hi, friends, and thank you for joining us once again for the Saturday Frights podcast. For this week, as we continue the month-long celebration of October, we have chosen the 1995 big-screen offering from the popular HBO Tales from the Crypt TV series, entitled Demon Night.
Your choosing this to discuss did not have anything to do with Scream Factory releasing it on Tuesday, eh?
No, that actually didn't have anything to do with my decision to discuss it, Projectionist. I happen to quite like this movie. The fact that it's coming out on the 20th on Blu-ray is just a fortunate coincidence. With your love of the original EC Tales from the Crypt comics, my friend, I won't lie. I was a little hesitant to choose this.
I attempt to judge a film, Victor, on its own merits, and not from the source material it might be based upon.
Well, it looked like you were enjoying it when we watched it in Auditorium 6. You haven't seen much of the Tales from the Crypt HBO series, right?
Only the handful of episodes you've screened down here in the Retroist Vault, which I believe we talked about when we discussed the 1972 segment of the Tales from the Crypt theatrical feature called And All Through the House.
We did. That was episode 25, friends.
Now cut that out, Sage.
Sorry. Well, I was a pretty big fan of the TV show, although most of my early viewing of the series was thanks to the VHS tapes that HBO was releasing. They would have 3 episodes apiece on them. When I worked at the local video store in my neck of the woods, I can tell you, they rented very well. So I wasn't too surprised when I picked up an issue of Premiere Magazine to read that a movie was coming out.
I was surprised to find this wasn't released on the HBO, Victor.
The TV series was definitely a juggernaut for HBO, thanks in no small part to the amount of actors and actresses that were lining up to be on the show.
I would have thought that it was the Crypt Keeper who was the main reason for the television series' success.
Well, sure. He was an entertainment icon.
A charismatic host is exactly what every radio broadcast or television show needs. Wouldn't you say, dear listeners?
I see what you're doing there, Projectionist.
Doing what, dear friend?
Moving on. Demon Night didn't even start out as a Tales from the Crypt film. But I think we should talk about that after the synopsis.
Certainly.
Demon Night, or as it was sometimes billed, Tales from the Crypt Presents Demon Night, was released on January 13th, 1995. It's been said that Demon Night was to be the first of 3 Tales from the Crypt films, the other 2 being Dead Easy and Body Count, but those were never made. Anyway, each of those films were going to be released on either a Friday the 13th or Halloween. It was directed by Ernest Dickerson, and the screenplay was handled by Ethan Reith, Cyrus Voris, and Mark Bishop. Demon Night actually starts as a movie within a movie, including the Tales from the Crypt TV series intro, and that awesome score by Danny Elfman. Such a great opener. We learn we were actually witnesses to a filming of a Tales from the Crypt episode, with a great cameo by Night Court's John Larroquette. The Crypt Keeper then leads us into the movie proper. We immediately meet two of our main protagonists, locked in a nighttime high-speed car chase on a lonely stretch of road in New Mexico. Although we will learn their names a little later in the movie, we have Frank Breaker leading the chase, wonderfully played by William Sadler, and a charismatic Billy Zane right behind as the Collector. That is his character's name, as well as his sole occupation.
I'm beginning to think you have something of an infatuation with Billy Zane, Victor.
Dude is awesome, and he totally steals every scene he's in. The car chase ends when Breaker runs out of gas and uses his vehicle as a blockade on the road. He pulls out a rifle and begins shooting at the approaching Collector. The result is a fiery explosion and car crash combined, one that almost claims Breaker's life. Wounded, the disheveled man walks off, but not before pulling a glove off his right hand and staring at a strange tattoo. We see seven tiny pentagrams. Three of them glow with an orange light, and one moves across the skin of his palm. This seems to get Breaker moving quicker, and he heads off into the night, where he learns he has stumbled into the dying town of Wormwood, a very appropriate named place, considering the burden Breaker must bear. No way to avoid spoilers here, and I'm jumping ahead just a bit, but Breaker is in fact our hero of the film, with the Collector, well, that is a whole other kettle of fish. After failing to steal a car at a diner, Breaker meets Uncle Willie, played by the legendary Dick Miller, who tells him about a boarding house he can crash at, no pun intended, an old decommissioned church run by the feisty Irene, portrayed perfectly by C.C. Pounder. Breaker and Uncle Willie aren't the only guests. There is also Cordelia, who is a soiled dove. Also, there's a recently fired postal worker named Wally, and a young woman, a convict from a work release program named Geraldine, played by Jada Pinkett Smith. After Breaker pays for room and board with a rather large wad of cash, we learn that the Collector has also survived the car crash, as he makes his presence known to the bumbling Deputy Bob and the rather grouchy Sheriff Tupper. The Collector explains he was chasing the other man because he had stolen a very valuable antiquity. He also skillfully convinces the two lawmen of the danger that Breaker poses to their little town, and soon, thanks to a call from Irene, who is suspicious of her new boarder, the lawmen and the Collector arrive at the boarding house. Oh, I almost forgot to mention, before that trio show up, we are introduced to the less-than-charming Roach, played by Thomas Hayden Church. He's there to visit Cordelia. When the Collector and the lawmen show up, Breaker knows he's been pushed into a corner. We quickly find out what the Collector is after. It's an odd item. It is gold and key-like in appearance, with the bow portion made of glass, filled with a dark liquid. A dark red liquid. The Collector tries to get Uncle Willie to not only place the key in a special box he's brought along, but asks the elderly man to pour out the liquid before doing so. This causes Breaker to plead with the older man, but the matter is taken out of their hands when the sheriff arrests them both. It turns out, each of the cars involved in the fiery crash were stolen, and he for one plans to get to the bottom of all of this at the station. The Collector tries to talk his way out of the situation, and when that fails, he snaps his handcuffs and punches Sheriff Tupper in the face. Actually, I should clarify, he actually punches straight through the sheriff's face, and ripping the dead lawman's head off, he tosses it at Deputy Bob. While most everyone is in an utter state of shock and confusion, the Collector attempts to kill Breaker, who, while being choked to death, is able to get his hands again on the key and presses it against the Collector's face, which results in two things: a horrid burn for the attacker, who flees by jumping out a window, and an absolutely hilarious rant when he starts to throw a tantrum outside the boarding house.
Humans! You're not worth the flesh you're printed on! Scowling.
Podunk, podunk, well then there.
All you have to do is give me the key! And we could get on with our lives. All right, this property is hereby condemned.
Sorry to those of you that know Demon Knight very well. I had to edit that clip a little. We do attempt to be an all-ages podcast. That scene, when I originally saw Demon Knight in the theater, absolutely brought the house down. I mean, it was solid laughter in the auditorium for a couple of minutes. That memorable moment also happened to be unscripted. It was improvised wholly by Billy Zane on the day of filming. The Collector, regaining his composure, slices open a palm of his hand, bleeding a green, noxious-looking liquid, which he begins to sling on the ground around him. in what looks to be an inverted cross pattern. Soon, from that bubbling pool of liquid are born glowing green-eyed demons, who waste no time in attempting to kill those within the boarding house. Luckily for them and our heroes, it turns out that the blood in the key, when dripped in a door frame or say that broken window, creates a kind of barrier. If the demons try to pass through, they will literally explode. We learn, thanks to the foolish actions of Roach and Cordelia, that to slay the demons, one can also destroy their eyes.
You know the old saying, dear listeners. The eyes are the windows to the soul.
Yeah, particularly in this case. It turns out when dispatching a demon, you also risk getting hit by a backlash of energy. Hellfire, perhaps. So there are bad news no matter how you look at it. Breaker has the unfortunate duty to inform those within the former church that they have to wait it out until morning. The demons won't be able to survive the daylight. I'm going to stop my synopsis here, but add that we learn what really is at stake if the Collector gets the key. Breaker explains that after God created the Earth, in the darkness there were demons who controlled the power of the cosmos with the aid of 7 keys. And when God created the light, it destroyed the demons' hold, scattering those 7 keys across the cosmos. The bad news is, they've collected them all again, but one, the key that is in Breaker's possession. That blood within the key that keeps the demons at bay is partly the blood of Christ. I say partly because those that come to protect the key are gifted with immortality while they own it, but when they are slain, before passing it on to the new demon knight, they refill it with their own blood. Remember me saying Breaker had 7 pentagrams tattooed on his palm? When those little pentagrams move and form a perfect circle, the demon knight knows his time is up and must be ready to pass on the key to a new protector. Can Breaker escape the wrath of the Collector? Will any of the boarding house residents be able to resist the power and temptation that the Collector can offer if they turn over the key? Find out for yourself when you watch Demon Knight.
For those of you who have not seen this film for yourself, I will add to Victor's long-winded synopsis that it successfully manages to balance humor with its scares.
Absolutely, projectionist. Demon Knight is an ensemble piece, and it really succeeds thanks to the cast. Like I've already mentioned, it's Zane, I think, that shines the brightest, but his character of the Collector does lend itself well to chewing the scenery.
In my humble, yet expert opinion, it is Thomas Hayden Church that steals the film. Villains are always more memorable.
Really? I'll agree his portrayal of Roach is fantastic. You certainly love to hate him, but I wouldn't say his performance is more memorable than, say, Sadler's. The way he plays Breaker is so perfect, you can almost feel the weight of the years he's been running to keep the keys safe. And even before we learn that he's the good guy, there's something in his actions that clue us in on his nobility.
Oh, yes, his nobility. Like when he attempts to steal that car from the diner.
Projectionist, he's trying to get as far away as he can from the Collector. I don't think he was tempted to steal it to go out for a joyride. The fear of failing, bringing about the end of humanity itself, is kind of forcing his hand, you know?
William Sadler and Billy Zane certainly have an on-screen chemistry. They played well off one another.
That whole cat-and-mouse relationship between them at the beginning really pops and stands out.
On that, Sage, we can agree. I would also say that C.C. Pounder commanded your attention when she was on the screen.
Her character has a pretty interesting story arc. She and Deputy Bob, to be fair, end up showing they have the stuff to be heroes.
Now, before you begin that thing you call a synopsis, you were saying that Demon Knight wasn't intended to be a Tales from the Crypt offering.
That is correct. Thanks for reminding me, friend. With the TV series, most stories were taken from an EC comic offering. You know, Vault of Horror, The Haunt of Fear, and of course, Tales from the Crypt. Demon Knight was written in 1987. HBO's Tales from the Crypt wouldn't even be created until 1989. It was actually going to be directed by Fright Night's Tom Holland. He had intended it to be his follow-up film after 1988's Child's Play, but that didn't come to pass. Then the script was worked on and held by Pumpkinhead screenwriter Mark Carducci, who failed to get it a green light. For a moment, though, it looked like Mary Lambert, who directed the hit Stephen King adaptation Pet Sematary, would be the one to shepherd the film into production. But after Pet Sematary 2 didn't perform as expected at the box office, she couldn't find the backing to get Demon Knight made. The script then made its way to none other than Charles Band's Full Moon Features. When we tackle a Full Moon film on the podcast, I will be sure to go into greater detail. But in the late 1980s and early 90s, Full Moon was a horror and sci-fi fan's dream come true. They created the Puppet Master series, Trancers, and Subspecies, to name a few. Band 2 was unable to get the finances needed for Demon Knight, which is how the script was bought by Joel Silver, who was an executive producer for the now popular Tales from the Crypt TV series. He saw the potential in Demon Knight marking the Tales from the Crypt series' first feature film. Partner Universal Pictures, though, quibbled about the budget for the film.
Of course they did. Why let the artists attempting to bring a film to life have what they need?
Friends, there was a point where there wasn't going to be any demons in Demon Knight. Not like we see in the finished film. Universal had a script drafted up in an effort to lower the budget, where the collector presented himself as a Bible salesman. His minions in this draft of the screenplay were fellow Bible salesmen dressed in black suits and black sunglasses that would later be explained as demons in human form, like the collector. Eventually, calmer heads prevailed, and the money was released so that those lovable beasties we see in the movie could be made. I guess those execs at Universal who were concerned about the budget would have to wait patiently for 2 more years for Columbia Pictures' wildly successful Men in Black before they were happy. You know, Columbia began working on the Men in Black film back in 1995. Coincidence?
Yes.
Yeah, you're right, projectionist. Well, as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, Demon Knight was intended to be the first of 3 Tales from the Crypt films. I guess those plans were halted when 1996's Bordello of Blood was released and failed to find an audience. With a budget of $13 million, it earned a mere $5.8 million at the box office. The key from Demon Knight makes an appearance in Bordello of Blood, and has been said it was intended to be seen in the 3rd Tales from the Crypt film as well, but that sadly never came to be. I think we should also mention that when Demon Knight was released, it had a rather rocking soundtrack featuring the likes of Megadeth, Pantera, Ministry, Machine Head, The Rollins Band, Biohazard, The Melvins, Sepultura, Filter, and The Gravediggers. Projectionist? I see you have the projector threaded up. What do you have in store for the listeners?
Why only the finest in theatrical advertisements, Victor?
Enter Death's waiting room, if you dare. Below the crypt lies the vault of horror. A treasure chest of the macabre. Madness. Voodoo. Vampires. Torture. And terror. All the things that make life worth living.
How it is, and how it always will be.
The Vault of Horror.
From a secret grave in a distant land, Hell's Madam has risen again. And now she's back in business at the Bordello of Blood. Where customers go in.
Evening, boys.
This is deep.
But they don't come out.
Mr. Gutman, have you found my brother yet?
He and a friend of his evidently went to a local brothel.
Are you ready?
Welcome to a new chapter in terror.
At least now she'll know what's eating him. She is.
Lucy, I'm home.
Let's party.
Sorry, I'm Mexican for lunch.
I'm gonna take you for a test ride.
You know, you make it sound really enticing.
From Universal Pictures.
It's holy water, man.
Dennis Miller.
You are out of here.
Cha-ching.
Tales from the Crypt presents Bordello of Blood. This summer.
No! You're looking cold tonight, man. You must know Mickey Rourke, huh?
Evil bites.
Go for it.
Hey, Tom Atkins. Thrill me. You better listen to Saturday Fright Podcast.
We're going to have to discuss The Vault of Horror at some point, my friend. That is a great anthology film.
Indeed.
We should pause and thank Retro Art Blog for being kind enough to get us that promo by the legendary Tom Atkins. Very much appreciated. Check your mail. You should find some comp tickets to the Retro's Vault Theater. Friends, before I jump into the notable cast and crew, I feel I should tell you the amazing amount of special features that our friends at Scream Factory have packed into the Demon Knight Blu-ray. Besides the standard still gallery and original theatrical trailer, they've loaded it up with a new commentary track by director Ernest Dickerson, an additional commentary track featuring special effects creator Todd Masters, visual effects supervisor John Van Vilt, special effects coordinator Thomas Bellissimo, as well as demon performer Walter Phelan. Also included is a new making-of featurette with interviews by not only Dickerson, but stars Billy Zane, William Sadler, and Charles Flesher, who played Willie in the movie, just to name a few. Then, there is also the panel discussion with Ernest Dickerson, Dick Miller, and the equally legendary effects artist, Rick Baker. So not only is Demon Knight a great film, but its bonuses alone mean you should pick it up on Tuesday, October 20th. Now, director Ernest Dickerson has 58 directing credits to his name, helming notable film and TV series such as 1994's Surviving the Game, two episodes of 2001's Night Visions, a 2006 Masters of Horror offering entitled The V Word, six episodes of The Wire, as well as 11 episodes of The Walking Dead. William Sadler has 157 acting credits, with notable roles in 1987's Project X. He appeared in two episodes of the Tales from the Crypt series, starring in the very first episode, in fact, entitled The Man Who Was Death. Sadler was also in 1990's Die Hard 2, 1991's Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, where he portrayed Death, 1994's Shawshank Redemption. He was in three episodes of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, 1999's The Green Mile, and was recently seen in 2013's Iron Man 3 as President Ellis, a role he reprised just a few weeks ago on ABC's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Billy Zane has 143 acting credits, with notable appearances in Back to the Future and its 1989 sequel. Also, in 1989, he co-starred with Nicole Kidman and Sam Neill in Dead Calm. He was in 1990's Memphis Belle, five episodes of 1991's Twin Peaks. He made an appearance in a 1993 episode of Tales from the Crypt entitled Well-Cooked Hams. That same year, he appeared in Tombstone. He starred in 1996's criminally overlooked film adaptation of King Features comic strip hero The Phantom, and in 1997 was in a small film that had a modest box office take called Titanic. Of course, he also appeared in 2001's Zoolander.
Wait, what are you doing, Sage?
Don't do this, Derek.
Listen to your friend Billy Zane. He's a cool dude. He's trying to help you out.
Get back! Don't ever do that again! You have to keep this man crush on Billy Zane under control!
Sorry. Just love that scene. Jada Pinkett Smith has 38 acting credits to her name, with roles in such films and TV as 1991's 21 Jump Street, 1993's Menace to Society, 1996's remake of The Nutty Professor, where she co-starred with Eddie Murphy, 1997's Scream 2, 2001's Ali, where she appeared beside her real-life husband, Will Smith. She was in 2003's The Matrix Reloaded and Matrix Revolutions. And recently could be seen as Gotham City's crime boss, Fish Mooney, in Fox's TV series, Gotham. CeCe Pounder has 131 acting credits, with notable appearances in 1979's All That Jazz, 1985's Prizzy's Honor, three episodes of Hill Street Blues, 1990's Postcards from the Edge, 1993's RoboCop 3, the 1994 episode of X-Files entitled Dwayne Barry, 1997's Face Off, 24 episodes of ER as Dr. Angela Hicks. She was also in 2009's Avatar. Recently, Pounder could be seen in 29 episodes of the Sci-Fi Channel's original series Warehouse 13 as Miss Irene Frederick, and 28 episodes of NCIS New Orleans. Dick Miller is what I affectionately refer to as a workhorse in the industry, with 177 acting credits to his name, with notable roles in 1956's It Conquered the World, 1959's A Bucket of Blood, 1960's Little Shop of Horrors, 1966's The Wild Angels, 1978's Piranha, 1981's The Howling, 1984's Terminator, and in that same year, he was also in Gremlins, where he portrayed Murray Futterman, a role he would take on again in the 1990 sequel. Of late, he can be seen in 2014's Burying the X in the role of Grumpy Cop. Friends, I think that about wraps up this episode. On behalf of the Projectionist and myself, we thank you for listening to the Saturday Frights podcast. If you did enjoy the show, we hope you'll hop on over to the Retroist every Saturday, where we present everything from classic horror TV shows to the best in frightening shorts. The music you hear at the beginning of the show was provided by Peachy. If you'd like to contact him, you may do so at peachy@retroist.com. Our new ending theme is entitled Twisted Toys and was composed by the talented Tony Longworth. You can listen to even more of his music on SoundCloud and on his official site, which you can reach at www.tonylongworth.com. Of course, I have to give thanks for the invaluable feedback to my co-host, The Projectionist. Where can your fans find you if they need to contact you?
Oh, sorry, I had dozed off. Sometimes I am on the Facebooks. Projectionist, Haunted Drive-In.
If you are new to our show, we do have a Saturday Frights Facebook page as well, and we would greatly appreciate it if you could stop by and give us a like, or even let others know about it. It's another spot where we can share our love of retro horror with you, and not have to wait until Saturday to do so. Of course, our podcast is available on iTunes and Stitcher, and we would certainly appreciate it if you could click subscribe, maybe even leave us a nice review if you're pleased with our work. I can be found nearly every day on The Retroist. If you have any suggestions for future shows or even feedback, you can contact me at vicsage@retroist.com. We owe a great debt of gratitude to The Retroist himself for not only allowing us to record here in The Retroist vault, but hosting the podcast as well. When you have your retro needs, and we all do, just head over to www.retroist.com. Until next time, the vault is sealed.
On display this evening, a pastiche of painting from Oddball Land. The poet Sir Max Beerbohm reflected that no one ever died of laughter. Object of brush and palette, the rebuttal. The clown is Jackie Slater, his occupation, a comedian. His aspirations, to collect funny bones and hang them on the walls of his life to hide the cracked plaster and yellowed wallpaper that is part of the interior decoration of failure. Poor Jackie Slater. A bad joke told in a foreign language in an empty hall. The comic unable to coax laughter. The painting is called Make Me Laugh, and this lightless limbo is called the Night Gallery.
This has been a Retroist production. Goodbye.